Welcome to Race, Violence, and Medicine. I am Dr. Brian H. Williams, and I want to thank you for tuning into the show. We are now on episode 5, which is our final installment in our week-long series covering the topic of gun violence. And if you've been following along, you know I've been wanting to feature all of the speakers from the Kansas City Firearm Violence Symposium that was put on by Dr. Rob Winfield, who is a trauma surgeon in Kansas City. I want to feature everybody except for myself, of course. If I did that, that'd be the definition of narcissism. However, I must admit, there is one speaker who I could not get recorded in time to meet the deadline. So I may have to get her later in the season. However, I am not going to leave you hanging. This is the beauty of being the producer and host and content creator and editor and distributor of my own show. Is that I get to make stuff up as I go along. So in order to fill in this last episode, I know we're in season 2. I went way back to season 1. I dug deep in the archives, dusted off this classic episode. You cannot get this episode anywhere else. It features Clark Neely, and he's going to give us a different take on this discussion of gun violence. Why is that? If you've heard of a case called District of Columbia versus Heller, you will know why. Clark argued that case before the Supreme Court, and it was that case that definitively answered the question about whether or not you can own a gun. And that was in 2008, y'all, like 11 years ago. All this time, you may have thought you could own a gun, but it wasn't until that case was decided that the Supreme Court definitively said yes. Clark was the guy that argued that case before the Supreme Court. Why did he take that case? And what was his reasoning? That's next on Race, Violence, and Medicine.
I'm Clark Neely, Vice President for Criminal Justice at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. I'm also a constitutional litigator and author of Terms of Engagement, How Our Courts Should Enforce the Constitution's Promise of Limited Government. I was co-counsel in District of Columbia v. Heller, the Second Amendment case in which the Supreme Court protected the right to own a gun in 2008. You are listening to Race, Violence, and Medicine.
Thanks for joining me. You are listening to Race, Violence, and Medicine. I am Dr. Brian H. Williams, your host. Now, I have to ask you a question. What do you think is the role of the judiciary in our country? Do you think it's their role to protect your rights? Well, I'm sitting here today with Clark Neely, and you may not know his name, but some of the work he's done certainly impacts your life, particularly if you have opinions about the ongoing gun debate in this country. Clark Neely works for the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian think tank out of Washington, D.C., but he has a distorted career as an attorney, which for me to list off all of his accomplishments would take the remainder of this show, but we'll get into that as we start talking. But Clark, thank you for joining us today. I appreciate you taking out the time to talk to us.
Thanks for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here.
So first, let's start. Well, I forgot to mention your book, Terms of Engagement. And what's the full title of the book again?
Terms of Engagement, How Our Courts Should Protect Your Constitutional Right to Limited Government.
Okay. So before we get into that, give us some of your credentials, your street cred, your background.
So I went to the University of Texas for undergrad and law school, and I spent about 4 years working for a big law firm in Dallas, Texas, but I realized that wasn't really what I wanted to do the rest of my life. After sort of taking a break to think things over, I went to work for a public interest law firm called the Institute for Justice in Washington, D.C. And basically what they do, they're a libertarian public interest law firm. They sue government officials when the government violates people's rights and prevents them from enjoying freedoms and liberties that are protected by the Constitution. I did that for 17 years, and then just about a year and a half ago, I moved over to the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian think tank in Washington, D.C., to take over their criminal justice program.
So I guess we should probably start first with this District of Columbia versus Heller case, because the gun reform, gun violence debate is ongoing and it's reaching a fever pitch right now. So this is an historic case that changed the narrative about gun ownership in this country. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so a big question throughout most of American history was whether individuals had a right to own a gun. And for much of our history, the answer to that question was basically, if you are white, the answer is yes. And if you are white and well-connected, you can also take that gun wherever you want. And sometimes this was made explicit in the law, and sometimes it was simply just because even if technically there were some restrictions on the books, it was understood those didn't really apply to white men. And the question basically is whether everybody, regardless of race, color, gender, has a constitutional right to own a gun. And the Supreme Court strangely never answered that question. And it's really strange. I mean, the Second Amendment is 1/10 of the Bill of Rights. And yet, as late as 2002, which is when we filed the lawsuit, we had no answer to that question. Literally not the Supreme Court, no lower federal court had ever tried to definitively answer the question. There were 8 or 9 federal courts of appeals that had weighed in, but without any real significant analysis. They simply just in a sentence or two said, well, whatever the Second Amendment means, it doesn't protect an individual right. So we felt that it was time for the U.S. Supreme Court to finally interpret the Second Amendment and tell us once and for all, does the Second Amendment protect an individual right or does it not? So we filed a suit in Washington, D.C., which happened to be the one place in the country where two things were true. First, it had the most sweeping gun restrictions, really in the history of America. It was a total ban on handguns and a ban on all functional long guns. So you could own a shotgun or a rifle, but you could never load it. So effectively, it was a complete firearms ban. The other thing that was true about Washington, D.C. was one of the only jurisdictions in the country where the federal courts had not already interpreted the Second Amendment as being essentially meaningless. And so it was a sort of a blank slate with a very restrictive gun law. And so we filed suit challenging Washington, D.C.'s gun ban.
So I feel I have a firm grasp from a macro level about some of the issues surrounding the rights to gun ownership, but I'm certain there's nuances in this argument that you placed before the Supreme Court that I don't understand. How do you break that down for someone who does not have the sort of legal training that you do?
Well, listen, up until basically the late 1970s, there was almost a uniform understanding among judges and academics that the Second Amendment doesn't really mean anything, that basically it protects a collective right to own a gun. I was a Russian major. I've been to the Soviet Union. I know exactly what collective rights are. They're nothing. They mean nothing. So that was really just a fancy way of saying the Second Amendment doesn't really mean anything. In the late 1970s, early 1980s, a handful of academics really started digging into the question and taking a serious look at the history, taking a serious look at the meaning of the text of the Second Amendment, which, for those who don't recall, reads, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And really what happened was you had two camps. You had one camp that put tremendous emphasis on the so-called militia language of the Second Amendment. So this is really just about, the status of people serving in militias. And then the other camp said, no, for a number of reasons, it's erroneous to put that interpretation on the militia clause. The main and most important part of the Second Amendment is the so-called operative clause, the one that says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And basically, this scholarship just continued, and the pro-individual rights interpretation became so persuasive and so dominant that it really ended up being sort of the consensus among most people who took a careful look at the Second Amendment, including, by the way, a number of very influential left of center, and not just left of center, but like hard left law professors who wrote articles that essentially said, look, I hate guns. I would never support adopting an individual right to own a gun. But when you look at the history of the Second Amendment, it's undeniable. It does protect an individual right. So we essentially marshaled this scholarship. We went out and found 6 very sympathetic plaintiffs, people who felt that they not only wanted to own a gun, but that they had an individual right and a need to do so in Washington, D.C., and we represented those people and advanced those arguments, and we basically just, you know, kind of ground our way up from the lower court through the D.C. Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court.
So this began as a case within D.C. which had a complete and total weapons ban, and it was about individual rights to own a weapon within this restricted zone. And then it worked its way up through the court system to the Supreme Court, where the courts finally ruled on this in 2002. Is that what you said?
So we filed the suit in 2003, and the Supreme Court ruled in June of 2008.
That's not long. It's 10 years ago. That's not long ago. I would doubt that would have been decided longer ago, but just goes to show I need to follow my judicial history better.
Well, you know, you're not wrong to be surprised. It was very, very strange that the Supreme Court allowed the Second Amendment kind of, you know, almost alone among all of the provisions in the Bill of Rights. And, you know, there are other ones that are somewhat more obscure. The Third Amendment protects your right not to have troops quartered in your house, you know, which has not been a thing for a long time.
Right.
So that one doesn't have a lot of modern relevance. But there are lots and lots of people getting put in prison for gun-related crimes who might well have been acquitted if the courts had taken more seriously the Second Amendment right to own a gun. That was part of the reason why we felt it was important to finally get a definitive answer from the Supreme Court.
Well, I think this is just a great time to transition from this discussion about this case to what you talk about in your book as far as the role of the role of the courts, which some might call a cult, right? The role of courts in protecting individual liberties versus restraining governmental overreach. And so you talk about this in your book, Turns of Engagement. So we're going to take a quick break and then come back to talk about that. So you're listening to Race, Violence, and Medicine. You're listening, so you know where to find it, but you can get this at anywhere you get your podcasts. My main platform is Anchor FM, but please let your family and friends know where they can reach us, listen, and subscribe. Hang on, we'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Race, Violence, and Medicine. I am Dr. Brian H. Williams. We are here today with Clark Neely. He works at the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian think tank in D.C., author of the book Terms of Engagement, and he was co-counsel on D.C. versus Heller, which is a historic Supreme Court case which established, if I'm getting this correct, this established the right for individuals to own guns. That was decided in 2008. So before the break, Clark, we were talking about the role of the courts in deciding individuals' rights to own guns. And, you know, for this interview, I'm separating my role as a trauma surgeon and the carnage I've seen and talking about just pretty the legalistic issues surrounding this debate. Now, in your book, Terms of Engagement, you talk about individual rights, and I think you use the term armor around individuals and a fence around the government and the role of the judiciary in that. Can you tell us more about what you mean?
Sure. It's a big subject, and I'll try to do it justice in 30 seconds, and then we can talk more individually. But one of the most important questions in any time you're looking at the way a country operates is how much freedom do people have? If the government, for example, doesn't like you or doesn't like the group that you belong to, how risky is that going to be for you? How likely are you to get singled out, for example, and sort of tyrannized by the government? And, of course, that was a very significant question back during the founding era, the late 1800s in America. It remains an important issue today. And there's basically sort of two components to it. In America, we have a written constitution that establishes or proclaims certain limits on government. In some cases, those limits are individual rights that we possess, and I describe that as kind of providing a suit of armor around an individual. Other times, the limits are a little bit harder to understand in the sense that they're not so much a suit of armor around you, they're more like a fence around government that just says to government, regardless of people's rights, there are certain things you just cannot do as the government, and you're not given the power to do these things. And so these two kind of concepts, in theory, work together to protect our liberty. Now, I say in theory because let me give you sort of an analogy. Imagine you've got a sports car with an incredibly powerful engine, but the sports car has no transmission. That car will never leave the garage. It doesn't matter how powerful the engine is. It will not leave the garage. It's not going to go anywhere. It's the exact same thing with constitutions. You can have a constitution that contains all kinds of incredible protections for liberty, but if you don't have any means of ensuring that those protections are actually respected by the government, they don't mean anything. And the judiciary is the kind of metaphorical transmission that ensures that the protections that are set forth in the Constitution actually mean something in real life when the government tries to interfere with people's rights. If that happens to you, the person who's going to protect you and to ensure that your constitutional rights are respected, or not, but hopefully they will, is a judge, and no one else is going to do that for you.
So give them a report card. Give them a report card. How is the judiciary doing in that regard?
I would say depends on, if you talk to sort of a mainstream person, like a regular constitutional law professor or a judge, they'd probably tell you about an A-. I'd say it's more like a C-, because there's certain rights and certain restrictions on government that have basically just sort of been washed out of the Constitution, and for the past 80 years or so, really pretty much since the Great Depression, there are certain constitutional limits on government that basically almost everybody who works in constitutional law just sort of treats not only as if they don't exist, but if they never really should have, as if they never really should have existed. So if you sort of use that baseline, then we're doing okay, but you shouldn't use that baseline. You should use as your baseline the actual text of the Constitution, and if you do that, we're doing a pretty poor job of restricting government in terms of fully enforcing constitutional limits on government. We're getting probably less than half of what we're supposed to have.
So whenever there's a confirmation hearing that comes up, we hear about activist judges, and then I can't remember the other term, judges that strictly interpret the Constitution. What's the term for that?
Yes, strict constructionists.
Strict constructionists. But you say we should get rid of those terms and talk about judicial engagement.
And judicial abdication.
Okay. Yep. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I'll give another example. Let's say that you wanted to get a group of people together to protest, and you wanted to sort of, stage a rally in the city park or something like that. You have a First Amendment right to do that. Throughout our history, there have been times when the government will try to prevent you from doing that, particularly depending, on whether you're trying to send a message the government isn't very supportive of. There's all kinds of ways the government can do that. They can just overtly tell you you're not allowed in the park, and they can, put a line of police around the park and keep you out. But there's more subtle ways they can do it. They can say things like, well, your event is likely to draw a lot of counter-protesters who might be violent, and so we're going to have to, stage a big security presence, and we're going to make you pay for all that extra overtime. But then they didn't do that the last time somebody staged a potentially a controversial rally in that park. And so what you need is a judiciary that not only looks for the really overt stuff, like, no, you can't come to the park. That's easy, right? That's just obviously a violation of your First Amendment. Park is a public space. Everybody else gets to use it to make political protests, but not you. That's an easy case. What you need is a judiciary that recognizes that the government doesn't always violate the Constitution in obvious and blatant ways, and that it has all kinds of kind of more clever or at least less obvious ways to do it. And that's where judges tend to really diverge. And an engaged judge, what I call judicial engagement, will look at the situation, recognize that the government has all kinds of kind of more subtle ways to violate people's rights, and try to figure out what's really going on. And sometimes the government has a legitimate explanation for the the restrictions that it tries to impose on liberty. And then you sort of have to assess the strength of the right versus the strength of the government's interest, and some cases come out one way, some cases come out the other way. The dominant approach to constitutional law in America today, in my view, is judicial abdication. And what that basically means is just endless deference to the government. And to go back to my case with Trump, somebody wants to stage a rally in the park. Basically, if the government comes into court, anything the government says with a straight face, well, we're worried there's going to be a thunderstorm and people could get wet and they were going to bring some amplifiers, and if the rain got in there, somebody could get electrocuted. So it's just not a good idea. An abdicationist judge, which in my view is most of them, will hear that argument and say, oh, sounds fine to me. Yeah. And then, the other person would point out, well, but wait a minute. There have been rallies in the park before when there was rain forecast, and they got to do it, but we're not getting to do it. And the judges say, well, judge, government doesn't have to be perfectly consistent. Politics is a sloppy thing. I'm not here to make them, achieve perfect consistency. Even though if you could administer a truth serum to everybody involved, the government officials would have said, of course we're keeping these people out of the park because we don't like their message. But a judge who embraces abdication doesn't try to find out what's really going on, whereas a judge who embraces engagement does try to figure out what's really going on. That's the big difference.
So is it fair to say that I, as a citizen,
if I had an issue with the federal government and I came to the courts to have this resolved, I should not be screaming, this is my right to do this. I should be telling the court, you need to tell the government that there are limits to what they can do.
Yeah, sometimes. It depends exactly what the government is doing that it should not be doing. And sometimes, as in the example I just gave, your best argument is, look, I have a constitutional right of free speech, a right to assemble and petition the government, and that's what I'm trying to do, and you need to protect that right. Other times, what's going on is different, and what's going on is not so much that the government is violating a particular individual right, it's exercising a power that it does not possess. So take a look at Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution. It lists a bunch of specific things that the federal government is empowered to do, like create a post office and establish an army and a navy, and it's really not a long list. And what happened around the 1930s is that the federal government started doing all kinds of things that the Constitution did not give it the power to do. I'll give you one example from an actual Supreme Court case. There was a farmer in Ohio who was growing wheat on his farm to feed his animals and also his family. And under a new federal program, there was literally a specific amount of wheat that he was permitted to grow, and every other farmer was permitted to grow. He decided to grow more wheat than the federal government said that he could grow. And that case went all the way to the Supreme Court, where the question was, does the federal government, the U.S. government, have the right to tell farmers how much wheat they can grow and how much they can't? There is nothing in the Constitution about that. But the Supreme Court, engaging this abdication that I described before, kind of made up out of whole cloth this ridiculous theory about how the federal government can regulate how much wheat an individual farmer in Ohio grows on his farm, even when he doesn't sell the wheat on an interstate market or anything like that. And it's called Wickard v. Filburn, one of the worst decisions in constitutional history.
And I'm guessing that that has set precedent for generations on how the government can overreach is
yeah.
the term we could use in this?
It did, and let me update this for you. So in 2005, there was an incredibly important case from the Supreme Court which asked the question whether the federal government can criminalize the act of giving a neighbor, for example, some marijuana. And here's why the federal government can't criminalize that. I mean, the Supreme Court got it wrong and said they can, but here's why they can't. The federal government has no power over purely local activity. And that's by design. The Constitution specifically withheld that power from the federal government because they didn't want it meddling in the day-to-day life of ordinary people just going about their business. So, as you may have guessed, this case is called Gonzales v. Raich, involved medical cannabis. And a couple of women in California had some terrible health conditions. They got some relief with marijuana, but it was illegal under federal law for them to possess or to cultivate marijuana. So some friends gave them marijuana that had been grown in California. So this marijuana never crossed the state line mm-hmm. and was neither bought nor sold. And yet, the Supreme Court, using an absolutely absurd interpretive framework, said, well, the federal government still has the power to criminalize that act of giving somebody some marijuana using its power to regulate interstate commerce, despite the fact that there's nothing going across state lines and no commerce. That's an example of how ridiculous the Supreme Court has gotten when it really wants to uphold whatever the government is doing. It will just disregard what the Constitution actually says, make up some ridiculous theory like it did in Gonzales v. Raich, and say, yada, 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 the government gets to do what it wants.
Right. Okay, we're going to take another break, and I want to come, after the break, I want to talk about the Affordable Care Act and how some of these issues played into the decision, because that's something I can talk with a little bit of authority about, so I'm interested in hearing your perspective on that. So you're listening to Race, Violence, and Medicine. We are here with Clark Neely, his author of the book Terms of Engagement. What's the full title of the book again?
How the Court Should Protect Your Right to Limited Government.
So pick that up. You can get it at Amazon. And he's also works for the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank in D.C. And I failed to mention that he is also on the board for One America. So this is a conflict I must disclose. I'm also on the board. So we're having this discussion. You should be aware of that as well. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. Stick with us. Welcome back to Race, Violence, and Medicine. We are here with Clark Neely. He was from the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank in D.C., author of the book Terms of Engagement. And he was also co-counsel on the case District of Columbia versus Heller, which was a Supreme Court case that established the individual right to own a gun, which was decided in 2008, much more recently than I would have assumed. Anyway, before the break, Clark, we were talking about this issue of individual rights, what the government can or cannot tell you to do, and how that works in the, with the Constitution. Again, a lot of nuances there that I certainly don't understand. But let's talk about the Affordable Care Act, what people refer to as Obamacare. And specifically, I think the most contentious legal part of that was the individual mandate and the court's ruling on that. So can you tell us what the individual mandate, you know, is and how you feel about the court decision?
Sure. That? Yeah, so one thing to I want to front load is that it's really important to keep in mind that just because you think something might be good policy doesn't give the government the power to do it. I'm sure Jeff Sessions, for example, thinks it's a really good idea for the federal government to be able to criminalize the possession and distribution of drugs. The problem is that the federal government actually doesn't possess that power. It's not given to the federal government by the Constitution. So I would disagree with him on the policy, but what's absolutely clear is that as a legal matter, or I think it's absolutely clear, is that the federal government does not possess the power to criminalize the purely local possession and cultivation of drugs like marijuana. But that's an example where people might think something is a good policy. Still doesn't mean the government has the power to do it. Same thing with healthcare. The question with the ACA or so-called Obamacare is not so much whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. Reasonable people can disagree about that. The question is whether the federal government is given the power by the Constitution to enforce a law that, in effect, requires that people purchase government-approved health insurance. That was really the heart of the question with the individual mandate. So as written, I don't guess probably anybody's ever read the entire Affordable Care Act. It's more than 2,500 pages long. But at the heart of it,
even those that have voted on it and approved
it, right? Even the people who voted on it. But at the heart of it is this requirement that everybody, with certain limited exceptions, purchase with their own money government-approved health insurance. And oftentimes, this meant basically buying an insurance policy that wouldn't necessarily make a lot of sense for you. Young people really were the worst affected, because when you're young, you're relatively healthy. You don't consume a lot of healthcare services. And what's best for you generally as a young person is a kind of a catastrophic policy that just kicks in if you get run over by a bus or you get some terrible disease like cancer. But the policies that people were being forced to buy were generally policies that provided all kinds of services that, especially if you're a young person, you were never going to consume, but you have to pay for the insurance anyway. And in effect, what you're doing is you're kind of subsidizing older, less healthy people who are likely to consume all of those services. So you're going to pay for them, they are going to use them.
Right.
That's, from my perspective at least, kind of the heart of the individual mandate and Obamacare. And again, we can argue about whether that's a good policy or a bad policy. We have lots of other ways in which people are required to sort of cross-subsidize other populations. But the question in this case is, was it constitutional? Because there's just nothing in the text of the Constitution that authorizes the federal government to do this. And when you're talking about the federal government doing something, it's not your obligation as a citizen to identify a right to not do the thing. Like, I have a right not to buy this insurance. No. The obligation is on the federal government to identify a power that has been specifically listed or enumerated in the text of the Constitution that says, yep, the federal government has the power to do this thing. That was what the whole fight was about. Does the Constitution give the federal government the power to force every individual American to purchase government-approved health insurance? The answer, quite obviously, is no. As I mentioned during the last segment, you can actually just look at the text of the Constitution. Article 1, Section 8 lists all of the powers of the federal government and includes stuff like building a post office and creating a system of weights and measures. There is nothing there about health care. But the Supreme Court, as it so often does, kind of engaged in a bunch of, you know, sort of rhetorical gymnastics to try to come up with, invent a way of seeing in this limited grant of power that the Constitution gives the federal government some way of getting to healthcare and specifically government-approved health insurance. And as they typically do, they figured out a way to say yes.
Right. Interesting. As a doctor, I just feel that healthcare is a basic human right, and there's millions of Americans that don't have access to care, so I just need to figure out some way to get that care delivered to them in a way that is affordable and not create more barriers to care. But I recognize the legal argument you're saying here about the government telling everyone they have to buy health insurance, and I'm torn. I'm torn on that issue. So I'd like to find a way that we can get to some consensus of how to make that happen for everyone in this country. So back to your book, Terms of Engagement. You talk about judicial abdication. What are some solutions to, like, how do we improve the judiciary to ensure that they're more engage. And you say don't use terms like activism because these are weaponized, politicized terms, but more engagement to ensure that the government is restrained and the individual liberties are protected.
Yeah, it's a real challenge because as I suggested earlier in the show, one way to think about the Constitution is it's like the engine of a very powerful sports car. If you don't have a transmission to direct that power to the tires that are on the road, then it doesn't mean anything. Same thing with the Constitution. We have a very powerful Constitution when it comes to protecting individual liberty. But if you don't have people who will ensure that those protections actually mean something in the real world, then they really don't mean anything. And those people are judges. Those are the people who actually ensure that the Constitution means something. For about the last 80 years, the sort of mindset among federal judges has been one of what's called deference. That just essentially means allowing the government to do what it wants to, unless it's just, you know, engaging in some really blatant constitutional violation, like censoring political speech, you know, in a public park or something. But if short of that, they're just going to sort of say, you know, whatever you want to do, government's none of our business. And that's been tremendously problematic from my standpoint, because it really opens up so many doors for the government to just get into the very intimate details of your life and to regulate us in ways that the Constitution never meant for it to. So what's it going to take? There's no magic answer, unfortunately. It would take a more engaged judiciary, one that is more inclined to side with individual liberty over government power. Part of the problem there is that a vastly disproportionate number of federal judges were former government lawyers. We've actually done a study on this that we're getting ready to release. If you look just at the ratio of former prosecutors to former criminal defense attorneys, it's 4-1. If you look at the ratio of former government advocates of all kind versus former advocates for liberty, it's 7-1. So the vast, vast, you know, majority of judges, if you just look at people who used to advocate for individuals versus people who used to advocate for government, the vast majority of the federal judiciary is made up of people who used to advocate for government as their former job. So that's, I'm not saying that any individual judge is then, you know, stuck in that mold, but on a more macro level, it's very clear that there's a sort of a bias within the judiciary in favor of government power. That's a huge problem.
That is amazing. So the pipeline to the judiciary are folks that were prosecutors and advocated for the government in their day jobs and now are expected to sit and render unbiased opinions of what the government can and cannot do.
That's exactly right. That's exactly the part of the problem. And so, inevitably, there's a sort of a mindset. And I say almost inevitably because there are certainly individual judges who sort of buck that trend. But as a group, they are drawn from the ranks of former government advocates, by and large. And I would say that on the bench, they act like former government advocates, by and large. And I consider that hugely problematic. Okay. In terms of the solution, you know, we have to break through that somehow. But really what we have to do is to show that a more persuasive interpretation of the Constitution is one that is much more protective of individual liberty and much more demanding on the government, particularly the federal government, when it seeks to exercise powers that weren't really given to it by the Constitution.
Well, Clark, I think that's a perfect point to end. I'm looking forward to working with you on the board of One America. Where can our listeners find you after the show?
So I'm on Twitter at ConLawWarrior. That's ConLawWarrior. And you can also check out the Cato Institute's website. That's Cato, CATO.org, Cato.org.
And also his book, Terms of Engagement. Is it okay if I put it up on my website?
Of course, that would be great.
So just go to my website, BrianWilliamsMD.com, and I will have Clark's book there for you to check out, and it'll link right to where Amazon, where you can go ahead and purchase that. And in the show notes, I'll put his information so you can contact him through Twitter and the Cato Institute website. So you've been listening to Race, Violence, and Medicine. My main platform, I said, is Anchor FM. If you're on that platform, please go ahead and shoot me a message. I may end up in the show, but you can listen anywhere and subscribe. You get your anywhere you get your podcasts. Tell your family and friends, but also go to my website, BrianWilliamsMD.com. You can listen to the show there as well if you're not into podcast apps. But I'll make it easy for you. Just sign up for the newsletter, and I'll come to you. I make this so easy for you. Please send me your comments. I want to give you a show every single time that is worth your time. I appreciate your feedback, your critique, and your suggestions. This will conclude our show for today. Thank you for tuning in.